There we go.
So
Okay. So,
specimen. Sure, specimen of food. Let me tell you.
Linda was on the phone, and she's walking by, so I wanted to not have that on the recording. Okay. Okay. Father, thank you for today, and thank you that you're available to us at all times. And we ask you to speak to our hearts tonight as we look into your word. Give us understanding, give us willingness to hear what you have to say to us. In Jesus' name, amen.
I think the last we left off on was chapter 5.
I don't think we did 4.
Probably
Or
not.
did we? Yeah, we did do 4. Yeah, 5 was the last chapter. You're right. And the first thing that I have is chapter 6. Well, Naaman doesn't really involve prayer. It doesn't involve a miracle. This is the healing of Naaman. But 6 does. And to give some context, I'm going to start reading from verse 8. And it says, while the king of Aram was waging war against Israel, he took counsel with his officers and said, I will encamp in such and such a place. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, take care not to pass through that place, for the Arameans are encamped there. So the king of Israel sent word to the place of which the man of God had told him. Time and again he alerted such a place and took precautions there. Greatly agitated about this matter, the king of Aram summoned his officers and said to them, tell me, who of us is on the side of the king of Israel? No one, my lord king, said one of his officers. Elisha the prophet in Israel tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Go find out where he is, he said, so that I can have him seized. It was reported to him that Elisha was in Dothan. So he sent horses and chariots there in a strong force. They arrived at night and circled the town. When the attendant of the man of God rose early and went outside, he saw a force with horses and chariots surrounding the town. Alas, master, what shall we do? His servant asked him. Have no fear, he replied. There are more on our side than on theirs. Then Elisha prayed, Lord, open his eyes and let him see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes. He saw the hills all around Elisha covered with horses and chariots of fire. The Arameans came down against him, and Elijah prayed to the Lord, please strike this people with a blinding light. And he struck them with a blinding light, as Elisha had asked. Elisha said to them, this is not the road, and that is not the town. Follow me, and I'll lead you to the man you want. And he led them to Samaria. When they entered Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they may see. The Lord opened their eyes, and they saw that they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, Father, shall I strike them down? No, do not, he replied. Did you take them captive with your sword and bow that you should strike them down? Rather set food and drink before them and let them eat and drink and return to their master. So he prepared a lavish feast for them, and after they had eaten and drunk, he let them go. And they returned to their master, and the Aramean bands stopped invading the land of Israel. Boy, I can't stop coughing.
Go get some water.
I got coffee here, but it's not. I think I just got some dust in my throat.
Yeah.
So Elisha prays. We read through verse 20. He prays 3 times. In verse 17, he prays that the Lord open the eyes of his servants. And in verse 18, he prays that the Arameans be stricken with a blinding light. And then in verse 20, he prays that the Lord would open their eyes when they're in the midst of Samaria. It's amazing. The faith and clarity that Elisha has to be able to make these bold, requests with the assurance that they're going to be answered. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've
It's
always loved
amazing.
with this passage the idea that there is always this spiritual reality, but we just can't see it with the mortal eye, right? He says, they're afraid, and he goes, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." But he couldn't see that. That's why when he said, "Lord, open his eyes that he may see." And when he did, he saw the mountains full of horses and chariots of fire all around. So it's like we have this spiritual, army that is always there, but we just can't see it. It's amazing. I always thought that was really an amazing thing.
I think that's a true thing, John. It seems supported by the scripture. You remember when Jesus was before Pilate, and Pilate was questioning him, and he wasn't answering
Yeah.
him. Pilate says, "Don't you know who I am? I could have you killed." And he goes, "If it weren't, if I wanted to pray to my father right now, I could get
He would send
20
legions of
legions of
angels.
angels."
Yeah.
But he didn't. In essence, he's implying, "I'm being submissive to my father in heaven. This isn't, it's not your power that I'm afraid of." But it's
Yeah.
quite something. I like how, and this is a little off the fact, but how they, instead of letting the king strike the men down, these soldiers, he has them prepare a feast and send them away. That reminds me of what Jesus says too. He says, "If your enemy, do good to your enemy." And
Yeah.
it certainly had an effect. I mean, it was a strong message that they had no real power over the God of heaven, that's for sure.
Yeah.
In chapter 6, I'm going to switch over to the page here.
We're in chapter
Oh, we
six.
just did 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go to chapter 13 now. This still, Elisha is still the leading prophet during this time. We'll start reading in verse 1. In the 23rd year of King Joash, son of Ahaziah of Judah, Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, became king over Israel and Samaria. For 17 years, he did what was displeasing to the Lord. He persisted in the sins which Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had caused Israel to commit. He did not depart from them. The Lord was angry with Israel, and he repeatedly delivered them into the hands of King Hazael of Aram and into the hands of Ben-Hadad, son of Hazael. But Jehoahaz pleaded with the Lord, and the Lord listened to him, for he saw the suffering that the king of Aram inflicted upon Israel. So the Lord granted Israel a deliverer, and they gained their freedom from Aram, and Israel dwelt in its homes as before. However, they did not depart from the sins which the house of Jeroboam had caused Israel to commit. They persisted in them, even the sacred post in Samaria. In fact, Jehoahaz was left with a force of only 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers. But the king of Aram had decimated them and trampled them like the dust under his feet. The other events of Joash's reign and all his actions and his exploits are recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. Joash slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria. His son Joash succeeded him as king. It's interesting that here's a king who, it says, he did what was displeasing to the Lord. He persisted in the sins which Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had caused. And yet, when he is being chastised, or Israel's being chastised by the Lord, he pleads with the Lord, and the Lord listens to him. It says, for he saw the suffering that the king of Aram inflicted upon Israel. I think this shows how God is, it's not our holiness that is causes prayers to be answered necessarily. It's the will. Again, we talk how the prayer has to be concerned with the will of God.
Yeah.
I think what God is responding to is his love for Israel, for the people
Yes.
that he's chosen,
That's what I was
even
going to
though they're
say.
sinning against him. It's not just the king either, it's the whole group, but he still has compassion.
Yeah.
And he can be addressed on those grounds.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah.
That's for it. I was reading in I forget what book, but just last week how it says, something like when you touch them, you're touching the apple of my eye.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've always been it's that concern for his people.
Yes. This is a little aside, but I was reading here when I'm reading these names, especially in the next two verses, which I'm going to touch on because we're going to read on for another instance. I think it's worthwhile. No, you may know, I've already come across this. It says in the 37th year of King Joash of Judah, Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, became king of Israel and Samaria for 16 years. Have you noticed how the names almost the names of the kings in Israel and the names of the kings in Judah are almost identical over and over again? It gets really confusing sometimes, particularly as you'll see that, and you notice when I was reading even and trying to say Jehoash and that before the Oash sort of gets swallowed and it sounds like Joash. And then
Yeah.
in verse 12, you see the other events of Joash's reign. Well, who are we talking about?
Yeah.
Joash is the king of Judah, but this is the king of Israel because it says the other events of Joash's reign and all his actions and his exploits in his war with King Amaziah of Judah. So this is not the son of King Amaziah that he's talking about, it's the king of Israel.
Yeah, it's I think that we see that throughout a lot of history with authority.
The early
Well, just
sons of
like
Adam in
well, like
Genesis.
the kings of England, for example.
Yeah,
It's like
that's
how
true.
many, you can't keep that straight. It's all George.
Yeah, William, Henry.
Yeah, it's like
That's about it.
yeah,
John
George,
occasionally,
Henry, Edward,
but
yeah.
really.
And it's like King
Actually,
Henry. It's
William's
like
pretty rare too.
which
It's
one?
George and Henry are the big ones.
Yeah, and the popes sh recycle names all the time too, So I don't know what the
Yeah,
significance of that is, but
I don't know either, but it's amazing. The other place you see it is in the early genealogies, the line of Cain and the line of Seth, the names are almost identical.
yeah.
But it gets confusing, and I just was pointing that out because you almost have to make a little list to refer to keep them track of them sometimes. Verse 14. It says Elisha had been stricken with the illness of which he was to die, and King Joash of Israel went down to see him. He wept over him and cried, "Father, Father, Israel's chariots and horsemen." Elisha said to him, "Get a bow and arrows," and he brought him a bow and arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, "Grasp the bow." And when he had grasped it, Elisha put his hands over the king's hands. "Open the window toward the east," he said, and he opened it. Elisha said, "Shoot," and he shot. Then he said, "A narrow victory for the Lord, narrow victory over Aram. You shall rout Aram completely at Aphek." He said, "Now pick up the arrows." And he picked them up. "Strike the ground," he said to the king of Israel. And he struck three times and stopped. The man of God was angry with him and said to him, "If only you had struck five or six times, you would have annihilated Aram. As it is, you shall defeat Aram only three times." And I think this is it, although not specifically about prayer, and I think I may have mentioned this briefly last time too, but there's a principle here about it's about persistence in prayer, but it's about, I think, zealousness in general. Here's a person who's doing, he respects Elisha, he calls him father. But I don't get the feeling that this king, he wasn't really a good king. He's one of the kings of Israel. I think this is the one we were just talking. Is this the same? Yeah, this is the one we were talking about earlier, I think. Is it the same, Joel? Probably not. It's too far in the early. But he's doing what Elisha's telling him to do, but I don't think he's doing it with a lot of conviction. You
Yeah.
notice he's shooting the arrow. Okay, pick up the strike the ground. Okay. And he strikes him one. But it's not being done with
Conviction.
a spiritual understanding of what it signifies. And he's not acting, showing a zeal for what
Yeah.
he's doing. It's sort of, he's being very lackadaisical about it. And I think that it reminds me of several verses, Revelation 3, where Jesus through is saying prophetically, "You're lukewarm, and because you're lukewarm, I'm going to cast you out of my mouth, spit you out of my mouth."
I just
And
read that earlier.
yeah. And in Romans, well, I've got Romans 12:1. I have a few instances here. Romans 12 is good too to look at. I just want to get it. Oh, my concordance. And he says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice." But down at verse 11, where he says, he's saying, "Let love be without dissimulation. Be kindly affectioned one to another, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord." I think that's the key on the attitude that we, you know, that is showing that we should be having here, this fervency in our spirits. And then there's James 5:16 also, which supports this. James chapter 5, verse 16, "Confess your faults one to another, pray one for another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much." So I think the principle here in for prayer is it shouldn't just be a ritual or something that we do because we're obligated to, that we need to get through. If we're going to pray, we should do so with intention. And then we get the results that are most effective.
I'm reading gleanings in from Paul from Pink, and I didn't realize this, but the whole book is basically just focusing on the different aspects of prayer
Really?
in the epistles. Yeah.
Huh.
And because it's, I didn't know that at the time, but I just started reading it. And yeah, it's prayer and praise, instruction in prayer, prayer and hope, prayer for peace, prayer
So
for
it's
insight.
basically thematically focusing on prayer,
Yeah,
Paul's
taking
epistle.
it from Romans on. because there's really no mention of prayer in Acts.
Oh, there is. There is some, but not necessarily a lot.
Yeah, but what was my
Actually,
point?
when we do Acts, you're going to be surprised.
My point is that he said that in the introduction, something that what you were saying is that, oh yeah, that first of all, a lot or he was saying that all of the prayers, at least in the New Testament, are very short, brief prayers. But even though they're short, they're very specific. And I think he says, yeah, though exceeding brief, yet they are very explicit. They're not vague ramblings or mere generalizations, but specific requests for definite things. And then I love how he says, how many prayers have we heard that were so incoherent and aimless, so lacking in point and unity that when the amen was reached, we could scarcely remember one thing for which thanks had been given or request had been made, only a blurred impression remaining on the mind and a feeling that the supplicant had engaged more in a form of indirect preaching than in direct praying. That was really good. But anyway, what you
Yeah,
said reminded
that
me
of
of that.
course is something that's done often, where we try, it's a form, it's sort of what used as a way to summarize a sermon, but not necessarily always bad. I understand the point there too, is, well, we've read these things, now let's apply them by praying and asking the Lord to make them real in our lives. I think that's the
I don't
ideal there.
want to criticize that, or even I don't want to derail the conversation. But I remember when we were attending that church, there was this one guy in particular who would pray, and it was just like that. And it was even before the sermon. It wasn't. I don't mind a summarization or drawing on points that were brought up during a sermon. That's great. But these were. It was part of the introductory, I'm gonna forget what that's called. The stuff that they do before the preaching. Right?
I don't know what is that.
It doesn't matter, but you know what I mean. When we have the prayers and the singing of the hymns and okay. And he would pray and it would literally go on for like what 20, 30 minutes sometime. And it was just this, and I was like, man, this is really inappropriate. And he, I think Pink criticizes that. He's saying that that should not be done. And
Jesus says, when you pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking.
I mean, he goes on, he says, he goes, we note the brevity of the prayers of the apostles. Not some, not even most, but all of them are exceedingly brief. Most of them comprised in but one or two verses, and the longest is only seven verses.
It's interesting.
And he goes, how this rebukes the lengthy, lifeless, and wearisome prayers from many a pulpit. That's good, huh?
Interesting.
That's probably why the church doesn't promote Pink as much, all of his criticisms. But, man, that resonated with me. I was like, man, I get that. And I'm not trying to be critical, but I do think that your prayer should be short
And
and
specific.
definite and specific, yes, and not just rambling. So,
Very good, man. I'm going to go over to chapter 19. This is contextually, this is when Israel is being attacked by the king of Assyria. And he's surrounded the city with his army, this King Sennacherib. And it says in verse 1 of 19, when King Hezekiah heard this, now what did he hear? Well, he heard the message that the king is given to his officials, which he tells the officials to tell Hezekiah, which basically says, don't think you're going to be able to escape from me. Don't think your God is going to save you because I've destroyed all the other nations and I'm going to destroy you if you resist me. So when King Hezekiah heard this, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. He also sent Eliakim, who was in charge of the palace, Shebna the scribe, and the senior priest covered with sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah, son of Amos. They said to him, "Thus said Hezekiah, this day is a day of distress, of chastisement, and of disgrace. The babes have reached the birth stool, but the strength to give birth is lacking. Perhaps the Lord your God will take note of all the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, sent to blaspheme the living God. And he will mete out judgment for the words that the Lord your God has heard, if you will offer a prayer for the surviving remnant." Let's stop there and just comment. I think what Hezekiah is saying is they're so overwhelmed and frightened by what is happening that they don't even know how to pray. They're asking Isaiah to pray for them, in essence. They don't have they say that they're like babes that have reached the birth stool, but there's no strength to give birth. They feel helpless. But they're counting on, again, God's looking out for his own interests. They're saying perhaps the Lord God will take note of the words of the Rabshakeh, who has blasphemed the living God, and will mete out judgment for the words the Lord your God has heard, if you will offer a prayer for the surviving remnant. Which Isaiah does. When King Hezekiah's ministers came to Isaiah said to them, "Tell your master as follows, thus said the Lord, do not be frightened by the words of blasphemy against me that you have heard from the nations, minions of the king of Assyria. I will delude him, he will hear a rumor and return to his land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his land." And again, the Rabshakeh sends, I guess, sends a letter, and Hezekiah, it says in verse 14, takes the letter from the messenger and read it, and it says more of the same thing. You're not going to be able to escape from me. Hezekiah then went up to the house of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord and said, "O Lord of hosts, enthroned on the cherubim, you alone are God of all the kingdoms of the earth. You made the heavens and the earth. O Lord, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see. Hear the words that Sennacherib has sent to blaspheme the living God. True, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have annihilated the nations and their lands, and have committed their gods to the flames and have destroyed them, for they are not gods, but man's handiwork of wood and stone. But now, O Lord our God, deliver us from his hands, and let all the kingdoms of the earth know that you alone, O Lord of God." Then Isaiah, son of Amos, sent this message to Hezekiah. "Thus said the Lord God of Israel, I have heard the prayer you have offered me concerning the king Sennacherib of Assyria. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him." And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there's certain parts of this that are interesting. Verses 21. Let's see. Go start down. It says, "Well, he says, whom have you blasphemed and reviled? Against whom made loud your voice and haughtily raised your eyes? Against the Holy One of Israel, through your envoys, and have blasphemed my Lord. Because you thought, thanks to my vast chariotry, it is I who will climb the highest mountains to the remotest parts of Lebanon." And God further says, "I know your stayings and your goings and comings, and how you have raged against me. Because you have raged against me, and your tumult has reached my ears, I will place my hook in your nose and my bit between your jaws, and I will make you go back by the road by which you came. Assuredly, thus said the Lord concerning the king of Assyria." This is verse 32. "He shall not enter the city, he shall not shoot an arrow at it, or advance upon it with a shield, or pile up a siege mound against it. He shall go back by the way he came, He shall not enter the city, declares the Lord. I will protect and save the city for my sake and for the sake of my servant David. That night, an angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. And the following morning, they were all dead corpses. So King Sennacherib of Assyria broke camp and retreated and stayed in Nineveh. While he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons, Adrammelech and Sarezer, struck him down with the sword. They fled to the land of Ararat, and his son Ezra Haddon succeeded him as king. So not only is the Assyrian or the Assyrian forces struck a very serious blow, 185,000. Sennacherib was forced to retreat back to Assyria, and his own sons assassinated him. Probably because they felt he was weak, for having experienced that kind of a defeat. And this is also not just the end of Sennacherib, but it's almost the end of Assyria, because just shortly after, the Babylonian Empire becomes the dominant force in that in the area, and succeeds in Assyria's becomes just like not it's like they're nothing after that. They lose their power. So it's quite amazing. Do you have anything further to say, John, or should we just continue
Not
on?
on what we just read.
Okay. In chapter 20, it says, "In those days, Hezekiah fell dangerously ill. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amos, came and said to him, 'Thus said the Lord, set your affairs in order, for you're going to die. You will not get well.' Thereupon, Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord." Now, I love this. Here's another example of the non-fatalistic nature of reality. The prophets just told him, "Thus said the Lord, you're going to die. You'll not get what?" Hezekiah prays. And he said,
Right.
"Please,
In other
O
words, he doesn't just collapse in self-despair, right?
No.
Treating it as some like, well, this prophet told me that I'm going to die, and I guess I'm going to die, which is, I think, what a lot of people would do. They'd say, well, I guess I'm dying.
But here's the thing. It's not that the prophet is lying. I think we talked about this maybe in the past. What it I think is the reality here is all things being equal, he was going to die. What makes the difference is the fact that he prayed. Because it's not like reality, it's not like everything is determined. It's like things are God is the one thing that is what it is. He is what he is at all times. Because of who he is, at any given point in time, based on our reaction, you can say, well, this is what he's going to do. Given the situation, God in essence is saying, tell Hezekiah, you're going to die. Your time is up. The prayer, though, actually changes the condition. And now God can respond in a way that's consistent to who he is in a different way. And I think that's what's so beautiful. It's not like God is changing his mind. God remains who he is at all times. But because he is who he is, it has to be free to respond in a way that's consistent with his nature, given the situation as it
Just
is.
as he doesn't forfeit his righteousness while extending grace,
Right.
he is able to maintain his holy requirements and yet be merciful at the same time
Right.
without suspending either one. So, anyway,
Yeah.
that's
So I think that is really, really interesting. He turns his face to wall and prays, and he said, "Please, O Lord, remember how I have walked before you sincerely and wholeheartedly, and have done what is pleasing to you." And Hezekiah wept profusely. Before Isaiah had gone out of the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him. "Go back and say to Hezekiah, the ruler of my people, thus said the Lord, the God of your father David, I've heard your prayer, I've seen your tears, I'm going to heal you. On the third day, you should go up to the house of the Lord, and I will add 15 years to your life. I will also rescue you and this city from the hands of the king of Assyria. I will protect the city for my sake and for the sake of my servant David." Then Isaiah said, "Get a cake of figs," and they got one. They applied it to the rash, and he recovered. Hezekiah asked Isaiah, "What is the sign that the Lord will heal me, and that I shall go up to the house of the Lord?" Isaiah replied, "This is the sign for you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing he has promised. Shall the shadow advance 10 steps or recede 10 steps?" Hezekiah said, "It's easy for the shadow to lengthen 10 steps, but not for the shadow to recede 10 steps." So the prophet Isaiah called to the Lord, and he made the shadow which had descended on the dial of Ahaz recede 10 steps. He's talking about a sundial here.
Right. And so I was going to say that he essentially caused the sun to move back.
Absolutely inexplicable, but he caused the sun's shadow to go back, as if the world turned around. And when the sun doesn't move, it's as
Right.
if the world started to revolve backwards.
Yeah.
Or something else happened, but whatever, it happened.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the world went backwards. Maybe the sun did move. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if it's an incredible. Now, there's a similar thing with the sun in Joshua, where he calls on the sun to stand still while they're having the battle.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that isn't one where the sun goes backwards, but it appears to stop in the sky for the entire time they're fighting this battle. So and you can,
So
what I was talking
he,
about Assyria becoming less important, you can see hints of that in the next passage where Hezekiah is visited by an envoy from Baladan, the son of Baladan of Babylon. You see, Babylon is all of a sudden coming to the forefront. And this is
yeah.
when Hezekiah shows him all of his treasure, and Isaiah warns him the day's going to come when these people are going to come back and take everything that you have. But he is told also, "Hear the word of the Lord, a time is coming when everything in your palace which your ancestors have stored up this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will remain. And some of your sons, your own issue, whom your father will be taken to serve as eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." Hezekiah declared to Isaiah, "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," for he thought, "It means that safety is assured for my time." So he's assuming, since he's talking about his sons, that this is something that is going to happen in the future, which it was quite a ways in the future, actually, probably about 100 years. So it's his sons, it would be his son's sons that probably were more involved. The next and the final thing I want to talk about is King Josiah, and this is what's the relationship? I think this is Hezekiah's grandson, because his son is Manasseh. And then he dies, and his son Ammon succeeds him as king, and he dies. And Josiah, so it's his great grandson, is. The one that's being talked about is Hezekiah's great grandson. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. But Josiah is having some war. He was one of the kings who is spoken he's spoken well of. He actually, there's like a revival that takes place during his time. Nevertheless, when they're doing repairs in the temple, the high priest Hilkiah said to the scribe Shaphan, "I found the scroll of teaching in the house of the Lord." And Hilkiah gave the scroll to Shaphan, who read it. The scribe Shaphan, I'm reading in verse 9 now. The scribe Shaphan then went to the king and reported to the king, "Your servants have melted down the silver that was deposited in the house. They've delivered it to the overseers of the work who are in charge at the house of the Lord." The scribe Shaphan also told the king, "The high priest Hilkiah has given me a scroll," and Shaphan read it to the king. When the king heard the words of the scroll, the teaching, he rent his clothes. And the king gave orders to the priest Hilkiah and to Ahikam, son of Shaphan, Akbar, son of Micaiah, the scribe Shaphan, and Asaiah, the king's minister, "Go inquire of the Lord on my behalf and on behalf of the people and on behalf of all Judah concerning the words of this scroll that has been found. For great indeed must be the wrath of the Lord that has been kindled against us, because our fathers did not obey the words of this scroll to do all that has been prescribed for us." And so the king is asking the priests to pray for the people. And it says in verse 14 then that there's a response. Who's this? The wife of Shalom, son of Tikva, son of Harhas, has to keep the word, live in Jerusalem. They spoke to her because she was a prophetess, the prophetess Huldah. She responded, "Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, say to the man who sent you to me, thus said the Lord, I'm going to bring disaster upon this place and its inhabitants, in accordance with all the words of the scroll which the king of Judah has read, because they've forsaken me and have made offerings to other gods and vexed me with all their deeds. My wrath is kindled against this place and it shall not be quenched. But say this to the king of Judah, sent you to inquire of the Lord. Thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, as for the words which you have heard, because your heart was softened and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I decreed against this place and its inhabitants, that it will become a desolation and a curse, and because you rent your clothes and wept before me, I for my part have listened, declares the Lord. Assuredly, I will gather you to your fathers, and you will be laid in your tomb in peace. Your eyes shall not see all the disaster which I will bring upon this place." So they brought back the reply to the king. And what happens afterward is Josiah institutes an amazing revival where they destroy all the remnants of the Baal worship. But even though it says here in chapter 23, it says he fulfilled the terms of the teaching recorded in the scroll that the priest Hilkiah had found in the house of the Lord. There was no king like him before who turned back to the Lord with all his heart and soul and might in full accord with the teaching of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. However, the Lord did not turn away from his awesome wrath, which had blazed up against Judah because of all the things Manasseh had done to vex him. The Lord said, "I will also banish Judah from my presence, as I banished Israel, and I will reject the city of Jerusalem, which I chose, and the house where I said my name would abide." I just thought that. And shortly thereafter, Nebuchadnezzar invades the land. So That is what I have for
Second Kings.
Second Kings. Now, I'm following the chronology of the books from the Hebrew scriptures. So next time we're going to move on to the prophet. This is considered the prophets, but in the sequence, the next book would be Isaiah. And I know it's Chronicles in the King James because they're treating them as histories. But we'll get to Chronicles
We can
eventually.
go to Isaiah, that's fine.
Yeah,
I'm
I think it'll
following
be.
your
Yeah,
outline.
we'll do that, and then we will go through all of the prophets, and it'll be interesting to see that too. So.
No, baby Isaiah.
Yeshaya.
All
Do you
right,
want
I'm
to
gonna
stop
stop
the
the
recording?
recording, yeah.
Yes.